You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. My name is Arye Nair. I'm the president of the Open Society Institute, and my role this evening is to welcome you and to introduce the panel, and then I will join the audience. I'm very pleased that we are able to sponsor this event, but I have to inform you of one of the ground rules. Our legal department insists on this. I have to advise you that the event is being recorded and may be available on OSI's website. And therefore, if you speak up during the course of the evening, that constitutes your permission to be recorded and to have your comments available on the website. We're here this evening to mark the publication of the second edition of Crimes of War, rather revised edition. Of Crimes of War, what the public should know. I was a participant in the conference at Berkeley about 10 years ago that launched this effort. At the time, I would say there was still very little consciousness of the international law of war. And the purpose of the meeting was to see what could be done to enhance the ability of journalists to cover situations in which war crimes or violations of the laws of war are committed. I think that in the intervening decade or so, there has been a great deal of increased attention to crimes of war, but I think that the revised edition of this book is still an enormously important contribution to our understanding of crimes of war and violations of the international law of war. Among other things, of course, the conduct of the United States government over the last several years has raised a great many questions about our own adherence to the international law of war. The panel that we have this evening is very well qualified to discuss this issue. Anthony Dworkin is the executive director of the Crimes of War Project, and he is an editor of the book that is now being published. Sitting next to Anthony is Samantha Power. Samantha is the Anna Lind Professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. She's the author of A Problem from Hell, and she has a book coming out soon entitled Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World. And I suspect you'll hear quite a lot about that book in the weeks to come. And George Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker and the author of an outstanding book on the war in Iraq, The Assassin's Gate. Anthony Dworkin is going to lead off, and he's also going to moderate the panel this evening, and we will have time for questions. And when we have questions, please go to the microphones and line up to ask questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Arye. Thank you very much, and to the Open Society Institute for hosting tonight's event. And beyond that, I'd like to thank RIA and the Open Society Institute for their support for our organization, for the Crimes of War Project through the years, and particularly for our different language editions, which they've been very generous in funding. And I'd like to thank Samantha and George for coming tonight to take time out of their many other commitments, both professional and personal, that they have at the moment to be here. And it's hard to think of two people who are better qualified to represent the spirit of what we're trying to do with this book, which is to try and promote writing about international politics that's informed by a kind of humanitarian sensibility and a commitment to humane principles and humane values. So thank you both very much indeed. But my biggest debt really is to the contributors, all the contributors who've joined together in this book, because it is very much a collaborative effort. And I can't say it was always very easy getting contributors to deliver their copy, although the military lawyers were fabulous. It would come on the dot, 1,700 hours, the copy would be there. And you won't be surprised to hear that the journalists among us were the worst of all. But anyway, the book is here, it's done, and I'm very, very grateful to everyone who took part in it. And the really, I think the lifeblood of the Crimes of War Project is the community of supporters, the diverse group of people who are involved and who've come together in our work, both on the book and our website. Journalists, photojournalists, scholars, activists, people from the military, the foundations that have supported us. It's really a group of people who've pooled their talents and their resources with the aim of putting the law, the laws against war crimes and mass atrocities, within the reach of anyone who wants to engage with these subjects. So this is a community of people who are ultimately united behind the idea that calling war crimes by their rightful name can make a difference, that bearing witness to atrocities can help in however small a way to limit them and to create some measure of accountability for those who commit them. So those people who were involved in the first edition of our book, and the idea behind it really came from a small group who'd been together in Bosnia, notably Roy Gutman, David Reif, and Gilles Perez, who I think is here tonight, or if he's not, he should be on his way. And what they wanted to do was to kind of jumpstart legally informed journalism of war crimes, to give reporters who are often the first witnesses of atrocities and who have the ability, if anyone does, to make people care about these kinds of things, to give them the kind of knowledge that they needed to write about war crimes accurately, to make their talents and their words count. The idea being war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, these are enormously powerful ideas, enormously powerful terms and rhetoric that can mobilize public concern and can perhaps lead to international action. And therefore, anyone involved in covering conflict, working in conflict zones, should know what these terms mean and how to use them accurately. And that's why what we try to do in our book is to look at the law in practice. It's always grounded in a specific situation, often witnessed by the people who are writing, in practice, on the ground, the law at the sharp end. And since then, with, as I said, the support of the Open Society Institute, the book has been translated into 10 other languages, including Arabic, Russian, Spanish, French, and the Dari and Pashtun editions are going to be finished later this month. And we also have our website, crimesofwar.org, which attempts to take the same ideas and translate them into ongoing coverage of wars around the world and international justice. So the first edition came out in 1999, and doing this revised edition, even though it's only 8 years later, has been, to put it mildly, a sobering experience, because the earlier edition captured a unique historical moment, I think, when the big challenge at that point seemed to be getting these laws observed. We knew what the laws were, and we were committed to them, and we saw that they were not being observed, and therefore we thought, with enough attention, perhaps, we could get our own societies to care about enforcing the law. And things seemed to be haltingly moving in the right direction. But now it looks a little different. And you can get some sense of the extent of the shift in just these 8 years by reading the names, the titles of some of the chapters that are either new or had to be almost completely rewritten for this new edition. Detention, interrogation, terrorism, Guantanamo, prisoner of war status, Afghanistan, Iraq, occupation, private military firms, Darfur, Democratic Republic of Congo, courts and tribunals. Not all negative. The courts and tribunals chapter is one example of a positive development, but the overwhelming trend, I would say, is in the wrong direction. And who would have believed that even the chapter on torture would have to be substantially revised? So on the one hand, you have a continuation of the same kinds of conflicts that motivated the first edition, these politicized ethnic and tribal conflicts in Africa. And there's a debate which perhaps other people will talk about tonight during our discussion about how we can engage with these conflicts and how we can try and limit the brutality that they entail. And we do have these courts and tribunals and another debate now about how the attempt to impose accountability during an ongoing conflict will play out, and it's still early days in that complex process. But of course, the biggest development is that our own society's commitment to these values, the values of humanitarian law, which really seemed a given when the first edition came out, can no longer be taken for granted, I think. And more precisely, I would say that since 9/11, the law itself, international humanitarian law, has become contested territory. That is, in the United States, we have an administration now that has really questioned the continuing relevance of the underlying principles of IHL, international humanitarian law, in the face of a new form of threat from international terrorists. Terrorists of global reach is the phrase. And we hear that the principles of IHL may now be obsolete in the face of this new threat. The laws of war, laws of armed conflict, depend for their efficacy above all on clarity. The idea being these kind of bright line rules, even in the confusion and extremis of war, you can understand what they are. But the Bush administration, I think, has blurred and muddied the language and produced a situation where the values are obscured and flexibility is the order of the day. So we hear, among other things, that waterboarding is not torture. We hear that cruel treatment is not cruel if it can somehow be squared with your own elastic conscience. We hear that terrorists are not civilians under the law, but they're not combatants under the law either. We hear that keeping prisoners in secret black sites for years on end is not prolonged arbitrary detention, and that military commissions are not a violation of due process. And at the same time, armed conflict itself has become everywhere and indefinite in time. So that's why I think the stakes for what we're trying to do with this book are higher now even than they were 8 years ago when the first edition came out. Because if we want to fight back against what our societies are doing in our name in these areas, the law itself has to be where we take our stand. We need to defend the importance of these principles that have been laboriously developed over years, over decades, to try and mitigate the brutality of armed conflict and to limit the excesses, the abuse of state power. And it's been inspiring to see that some of the resistance within this country has actually come from the uniformed military and from military lawyers, who I think in many cases are very disturbed by the way that the integrity of the rules that they've been brought up to respect and really venerate has been debased. So an opposition based on the law is there. And I hope that this book will empower as many people as possible to take part in this resistance, to join in this resistance, and to engage in a public debate in as informed a way as possible. So this is a book not just to be read, but it's a book to be used, and it's a resource to be used. And I hope that you'll not only read it, but will use it in that way and share it and encourage other people to do as well. And if there's one single message that I'd want to come out of this new edition at this time, it would be to say this, that the moral compass that the law represents is not something that's primarily important in times of clarity, when you know who the enemy is, you know what the rules are. That's not really when the law comes into its own. On the contrary, it's precisely in the confusing and complex situation that we face today, with new forms of fighting and new kinds of enemies. It's exactly in that confusing situation that the moral compass represented by the law is most needed, because it's in that kind of situation there's the greatest danger of losing our way. So that's a short statement about the book. And now, to take forward some of the themes a little bit, first, Samantha Power.
Great. Thanks, everybody, for coming out on a Thursday night. It's great to look out and see so many of there are a lot of old Bosnia hands here, Emma Daly and Santi and Roger Cohen and Arya. And it's sort of amazing to think about, just as Anthony was saying, just about how clear things felt at one point in our lives about questions of the laws of war, and where the problems were sins of omission more than sins of commission. And it's a very different climate, as you're saying, in which you published the book today than you did the last time around. But I mean, ever more valuable because it's about us and compliance, in about a whole range of norms that we never thought were going to be subject to such themselves subject to such interrogation and retreat. I'm reminded of I had a sort of comical conversation a few months ago with Luis Moreno Ocampo, who's the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, and I was kind of slumped. We were having dinner, and I was kind of slumped over, and I was tired. We've been doing a lot of Darfur advocacy, and I'm trying to think Obama would be the best president, so I'm trying to do a little Obama advocacy and trying to finish a book, and just tired and drinking, and we were talking about the ICC, and you know, the ICC, it's like so quaint to even be still talking about the ICC. It feels, you know, when the sky's falling here. And he said, I think a really interesting thing. He said, look at you. He said, you can't even sit up. You're so tired. He said, the thing about activists and advocates is they get tired. Institutions never get tired. And that's why you have to build institutions. Institutions don't get tired. And I actually think crimes of war is like an institution, you know, that won't get tired. It's you've laid down the gold standard. You're going to be the keeper of the standards and the reminder of where the deviance occurs over time. And as you said, with your list of new subjects, all one will have to do is sort of look at the index to know how we're deviating and what needs doing. It's a great honor, of course, to be appearing with George, who not only has done the bravest and the most rigorous coverage of Iraq, which is center stage in all of our minds, but also I think does something that very few journalists do, which is kind of takes on the burden of problem solving, doesn't just give us laments about Iraqi refugees or about the getting out or staying in or cutting and running and stay the course thing, sort of false dichotomy of a debate, but really tries to constructively find a route. It doesn't mean you're going to agree with the route, but it's always grounded in the best faith, I think, of anybody writing about Iraq today. So, seriously. Anyway, enough with that. The subject, again, there is this kind of an anachronism, you know, we're going to mix apples and oranges, I think, and so I'll do the apples and George will do the oranges. But I thought what I would talk about is this other really quaint 20th century concept that has gotten legs in the 21st century, which is this something called the responsibility to protect. And what I find very interesting is, you know, people refer to the responsibility to protect. Do you have a listing of the responsibility to protect?
It's under humanitarian intervention.
Oh, it is. Okay. So my students and young people around the country, they're constantly talking to me, and in the old days I never even knew what they were talking about, because R2P this and R2P that, and I thought they were talking about a Star Wars character. But it turns out that there's this weird concept floating around, a new norm, which doesn't happen all that often. It's the perhaps metastasization of an old norm. But in 2005, 150 countries in the UN came together in the fall and agreed that if civilians were being kind of murdered or abused in mass at home, that states had a responsibility to protect those civilians, and if the states abdicated that responsibility, the responsibility would vest to the so-called international community. And it's kind of, again, very 1990s in terms of the tenor of the discussion. But embedded into the standard of responsibility to protect were a few outs, a few very useful outs for states. One was the question of threshold. So how bad did it really have to get in order to summon that responsibility, the responsibility first of the state and then to go further, you know, back to the international community? So does I wouldn't even call it a low grade. Does a high grade civil war in Iraq count? Does what's happening in Burma count? At what point does it count? When did Darfur count? Does it not count now if it's mainly rape and not mass killings? There's a whole lot of fungibility built into the trigger question. Then there's the question of when a state has in fact abdicated its responsibility to protect. So how many lies does Bashir have to tell in Sudan? How does one deal with a situation like Iraq where the capacity to protect by the intervener or the occupier or whatever is, or by the host country, is so limited? How do you even deal with these threshold questions? And then the third out is, who the hell is going to exercise this responsibility? It's a lovely idea. Responsibility is a great concept in general in all of our lives. We should all be more responsible. But it was an amazing thing to look at the General Assembly and to see countries with a lot of debate in the lead up to the vote, but countries really kind of in their own way taking pride in being for the responsibility to protect. And if you could count on one hand the number of countries of the 150 who had any intention of exercising the responsibility, I'd be surprised. And but this is where we start. And I think the responsibility to protect is, it's taken me a while to kind of catch on to the concept and to take it to pay proper attention to it. But I think it's a very interesting concept because I think it's a hybrid. I think it actually captures the moment we're in today in 2007. Because on the one hand, it's a relic from the 1990s in that it's this sort of increasing consciousness, the crimes of war constituency that exists inside government and outside in some measure, a recognition that certain sins and crimes are so egregious that they shock the conscience and that they demand international attention, they demand press covers, they demand human rights mobilization, and they demand government action, they demand opening the toolbox and pulling out some tools and trying to stop it. But it's a hybrid because it's also got in it the kind of, you might have called it once the, we might have dismissed it almost as the 19th century sovereignty fetish, but I would call it really the 21st century sovereignty fetish, the resurgence of sovereignty, and not just anybody's sovereignty, but the advocacy for the resurgence of sovereignty by the primary 21st century power, namely China, which I'll come to in just a second. So this concept tries, like all good norms, to be all things to all people, and it's a nod to Western democratic outrage and sensibility on the one hand, and a nod to the new recognition that states fundamentally would prefer, and this is an old recognition as well, but would prefer states themselves to be the keepers of the rules and the protectors of the civilians. So what do we do with this R2P, and where are we in when it comes to mass atrocity, systematic crimes against humanity, genocide? I think we in this community have perhaps maybe for too long talked in too a la carte a fashion about war crimes and crimes against humanity. And so what I'd like to do just here briefly is talk about the context into which we have to have this discussion and the degree to which the context is infecting our ability to see enforcement or to see responsibility exercised. So what is that context? Much of it is very familiar to you. First, the main point, we have these tectonic plates in the international system that have shifted massively over the last 6 or 7 years, basically since 9/11, but they were shifting anyway, and it just the gradient or the angle of the shift is much, much greater as a result of decisions made by U.S. policymakers, I think, in particular. But there are other trends afoot, and these plates have shifted, and we have to take them seriously if we're talking about crimes of war. One is the erosion of U.S. influence. And you know, I'm not saying the sun is setting on the American empire, but I am saying that our ability to get what we want in international settings is dramatically different than it was before 2003 and certainly before 2001. Influence, I think, derives from three things. One, hard power, just flat out military might and people's fear that you're going to blow them up. The other part of hard power, economic might of the kind that now we have much less of as a result of the deficit and the being dependent on China in a wholly new way. But influence also comes from other people's perception that you're using your power properly, so legitimacy. And, crucially, and often forgotten, I think, other people's perception that you know what you're doing when you use your power, competence. And on all three axes, hard power, legitimacy, and competence, the United States is on the decline. Doesn't mean it can't recover in a number of those areas, but it's going to require recovery in order to be able to go back into international institutions on behalf of issues like these and actually expect to have summoning power. And you don't have to, I mean, it's not, I don't think, an ideological assertion to say U.S. influence is on decline. I think you just have to look at our ability to get what we want on Iran, on Darfur, in some measure on Iraq in terms of Iraq's neighbors and other things, but there's a greater disposition or propensity to stand up to the United States pretty much on all issues at present. Second, tectonic plate shift, it goes without saying, is the rise of China, and not just the economic rise, but the increasing willingness to throw its weight around in international institutions, in particular in the Security Council. But it used to be that China would only use its veto on things related to Taiwan. It would even use it in relation to Taiwan if the Security Council was thinking about putting a peacekeeping force in a country that had recognized Taiwan. Then China would say, no, we're not going to support putting a peacekeeping force there, or there'd have to be some kind of side agreement. Where, well, it's not like that anymore. I mean, the evisceration of international consensus on Burma, on Darfur, on other questions like that, the toothlessness that is insisted upon by an increasingly energized China, and that's only going to increase. Then you have petro-authoritarianism, another tectonic plate shift, Russia, the backsliding there, which OSI does more on just about anybody and has paid the price for. And then you have Europe as a tectonic, I don't know if it's even, I guess it's not really shifting, but it's just a kind of static confusion, at least on my part, as to what Europe's role in patrolling the commons is ever going to be. And you see a great commitment at a bilateral level and a regional level, or European level, toward institutional development and toward development. But when it comes to actual emergencies or crisis response or sort of responding in times of need to atrocity, to government-sponsored killing or rebel-sponsored killing, there's not the same kind of constituency in those countries that you have emerging, anyway, in this country. And then finally, the tectonic, it's not really a tectonic plate shift, but a phenomenon that has to be taken seriously in this new context is the Iraq syndrome. And the Iraq syndrome, the shadow of Iraq, which hangs over all discussions of punishment, of protection, you name it. And that ranges from the taint that in the developing world around certain principles, around notions of freedom and humanitarianism in general, because of the misuse and the misappropriation of those words, the specter of quagmire, the notion that if you put troops in harm's way where there are ethnic or sectarian tensions or even mass killing, that you'll end up, as American troops have ended up, in great trouble. A crisis of confidence that related to the competence deficit, but about whether anybody knows what they're doing in anybody else's country, which I think is probably, there's a healthy part to that, which is, you know, a humility and a check on some of the hubris of the 1990s. And then there's the paralyzing part of that, which is, how do you go anywhere if you think you don't know anything? And then how do you deal with failing states and states that are committing, again, massive crimes against humanity? And then the final sort of part of the Iraq syndrome, and then I'll wrap up just with a few prescriptions, is is the a la carteism with which we wield morality as a country, we in the United States, the degree, I mean, you've mentioned this, Anthony, but to be denouncing genocide in Darfur on a Monday and endorsing waterboarding as a no-brainer on a Tuesday is problematic, just as a structural matter. It's problematic in getting anybody to care what you're saying about Darfur. There's just an inherent skepticism that our rhetoric on massive genocide, crimes against humanity, whatever, is about that. Or it's just a kind of intrinsic suspicion and belief it must be actually about something else. Because otherwise, there's always hypocrisy and discrepancies in policies. But this degree, this chasm, I think, is pretty substantial. And if you keep in mind, again, that other states don't have their own self-interested reasons to be reading crimes of war or to be heeding international legal precepts or believing that they have a responsibility to be part of enforcing those precepts, then this kind of suspicion is just another very, very significant thumb on the scale that explains inaction and lack of enforcement. So what does this all mean? Well, I think that if you look at two of the central tenets of this ethos, at where we were getting, and I think what George will maybe talk about in the Iraq context or in the civilian protection context, but I think we started to think about norm enforcement in the realm of punishment and in the realm of civilian protection. And again, when you think about civilian protection, when you think about both of them, there's a range of tools that you can bring to bear to try to ensure accountability. Maybe accountability is better than punishment, where punishment is one tool among many. But look now at, again, another outgrowth of the 1990s, the creation of the International Criminal Court, and the hopes of so many people in bad places, whether in Zimbabwe or Sudan or Burma, the degree to which The Hague has taken on a life of its own as a kind of oasis of justice that exists out there for people. And yet the discrepancy between that hope on the part of victims mainly and the ability of the court itself to actually enforce indictments without getting buy-in from states within the international system. Like, what are you going to do? What is the ICC going to do if you don't get the equivalent of a coalition of the willing to take seriously the indictments that they put in place? I mean, what is the backlash going to be like? What is, people talk about deterrence and whether the court can deter. How can a court that doesn't get to arrest anybody deter anybody? And I'm not looking at this in a short time frame. I'm actually wondering, looking ahead a decade from now, 2 decades from now, where is the enforcement teeth going to come from this institution that kind of got in the nick of time, but that depends crucially on state power and incentives, economic, diplomatic, and policing incentives. The same question on protection. Who is going to exercise this responsibility to protect? There's a constituency in this country that has made the Bush administration feel it has to talk about Darfur when it's thinking about two live wars, both of which are going terribly, one of which is going cataclysmically, the other which is hanging by a thread. North Korea, Iran, potential imminent attack on Iran, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, somehow Darfur is coming out of the president's mouth. That's because of this political pressure in this country. But in European countries, you don't see anything analogous. There's not that same, and I don't know, again, I'm glad you're in other languages and so forth, but whether there can be grass tops and grassroots ownership of these questions such that states feel like it's in their domestic political interest to take these issues seriously or not is going to have great bearing on whether these principles actually get the enforcement teeth they need. And then the second final point I'll make is just that I think an analog to this that we haven't, in our community anyway, such as it is, I don't think we think nearly enough about local law enforcement. And maybe it's not the international sort of war crimes, crimes against humanity, crimes of war crowd that needs to think about this. But if you look at the discrepancy between the amount of money spent on democracy assistance versus actually trying to figure out how to make police tools of enforcement of rights rather than tools of terror, or when you think about the amount of money put into dealing with, or the amount of thought put into dealing with corruption on humanitarian aid, but the total lack of thought about corruption that has you stopped at a stoplight in Kenya and forced to turn over your wallet just because the police has stopped you, I don't think the international system is oriented around crime or around law sufficiently. And we're actually more oriented around crimes of war than we are around actually propagating what Roosevelt used to call freedom from fear. And if we were to get the freedom from fear part right, more right, and invest more sort of hugely ambitiously, I mean, I think it requires a whole kind of conception shift, then you'd see, I think, these crimes, the constituency could potentially be thickened, but you'd also perhaps be able to capture crimes and lawlessness before it gets to the point where you're talking about international tribunals and responsibility to protect and so forth. So let me leave it there. Thank you.
I like that last point very much. I also am honored to be here with Anthony and Samantha and at OSI. Samantha and I are old friends, fellow Red Sox diehards. We're both trying to adjust to the feeling of being winners.
Avoid.
It's difficult, but I think we'll get used to it. And I'm also just so looking forward to Samantha's new book. She's already written one great book in her short life, and my guess is she's got another on the way. I was not a Bosnia hand. Just as in my teens, I spent those years wishing I'd been born 10 years earlier and had been able to experience the 60s as someone older than eight. I spent this decade wishing that Iraq had not been my war. I think I got dealt a bad card in having Iraq be my war. I heard stories from the journalists I met in Iraq about the Balkan Wars, and although I know they were searing and horrible experiences, there was also in there recounting an unmistakable glow of nostalgia for a war in which people who aren't accustomed to taking sides took sides, and in which when they talked about crimes of war, they weren't talking about their own side, the side they had taken, at least not much. In Iraq, that hasn't been the case, as we all know. But nonetheless, going to Iraq and going back over and over created a strange dissonance for me. It's hard for me to describe it exactly, but it essentially had to do with the fact that in Iraq, especially in the first year or two of the war, emotionally I had taken sides. And although I tried to be as scrupulous and careful and independent a reporter as I could, I knew emotionally that when an election worker was shot by a gang of insurgents in order to prevent voting from taking place, I knew that I was on the side of the election worker and not the insurgents. But when I talked about the Iraq War with people back here, many of whom had been strong advocates of intervention in Bosnia and other places, we always got back to the grounds for American involvement and the specter of American crimes in Iraq. Abu Ghraib cast an immense shadow over all these conversations. It really didn't cast as long a shadow in Iraq, strange to say. I think the Iraqis just knew that bad things were going on in that prison. Bad things have been going on in that prison for pretty much as long as most Iraqis had been alive. The effect of Abu Ghraib, I would say, was more important and more powerful outside Iraq, around the world and in this country, than it was in Iraq, where and I was there just after the story broke. It was a couple of very bad weeks for the U.S. Occupation and war effort, but it wasn't a decisive turning point in Iraqi opinion because so many other things were going on, and although the U.S. was responsible for a good deal of the bad things going on, unquestionably the insurgents were responsible for the worst things that were going on. So this really created an almost a state of psychotic dissonance for me, because the emotional and intellectual commitments that I felt in Iraq were at odds with what I knew to be legitimate horror on the part of people I respected back here at what was going on in Iraq and in the very fact that there was an Iraq war. Anthony mentioned, he used the phrase, commitment to human values in a war zone. It's difficult everywhere. In Iraq, I would say it's almost impossible because they were being flouted on every side. But this is maybe too much about me. What I'm getting at is Iraq sort of forced me, and I would argue others, including Samantha's colleague at the Carr Center, Sarah Sewell, to ask ourselves, do we want to record the brutality going on here and to hold especially the American side accountable, period, end of story? Or is there something beyond that that Iraq has brought out that people who care about human rights and about moral values and about crimes of war need to get involved in? And it all came to a head in February of 2006 in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, when the U.S. Army, particularly General Petraeus, Marine General Mattis, and Sarah Sewell, director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard, convened a conference on drafting a new counterinsurgency field manual for the Army and the Marine Corps. To me, this was a bizarre spectacle. There were journalists. Human Rights First sent someone. The Carr Center was there. I think Human Rights Watch was there. There were scholars. There were soldiers. There were civilians from the government, from the CIA, from the State Department. There were people there who, when I was in my 20s, I considered to be Darth Vader, a guy who had been a trainer of the Salvadoran military in the 80s as a Special Forces Army colonel, was now there as a civilian expert on counterinsurgency, and one of the absolute smartest, best, and most decent of the people who I got to know at Fort Leavenworth. So talk about cognitive dissonance. It was a very strange and interesting gathering. And I guess the question it raised was, you know, what are these people doing together, and do they really belong together? I mean, who's using whom, and is it healthy? Obviously, Sarah Sewell, who's a remarkable woman and who wrote the introduction to the counterinsurgency field manual, which has sold thousands of copies and was published by the University of Chicago and has actually been one of the key texts of the Iraq War, strange to say, a field manual that's sort of broken beyond its institutional confines. Sarah Sewell obviously thought that she belonged there and that she wasn't being used as cover for the nefarious purposes of the U.S. military. But at the same time, she was quite aware that there were tensions, to say the least. During that conference, the point that she made and that Petraeus made, so that they seemed at least in Kansas to be on the same page, was counterinsurgency, which, as I say, was to me a dirty word when I was in my 20s. And when I was in my teens with the shadow of Vietnam, for counterinsurgency to succeed, soldiers had to absolutely be true to the laws of war and to the ethics of war. In other words, it's not just a moral obligation or a legal obligation, it's a practical obligation. You mentioned competence as one of the three areas in which American power has been eclipsed in this decade. The point of that Sewell, Petraeus, and everyone else at that conference was making was part of our failure in counterinsurgency has been the Abu Ghraibs and the tiny Abu Ghraibs that go on every day, the humiliations visited upon Iraqis in during raids, the incidents at checkpoints in which force is used quickly and in some cases indiscriminately. Just in general, the sense that the Iraqi civilian population was a threat and therefore had to be treated essentially like the enemy, rather than, which is the whole point of this manual, the field in which the U.S. and the Iraqi government were contesting with the insurgents for influence. In other words, the doctrine put forward by this manual is that the key to a counterinsurgency is winning the allegiance of the civilian population, and you're not going to do that with Abu Ghraib. And in fact, that has all sorts of consequences for soldiers beyond simply being scrupulous about their conduct. It also means they're going to have to take more risks. In fact, force protection and overwhelming use of force, the Powell Doctrine, which had made a comeback because Iraq has been such a quagmire and a fiasco, according to this manual, is wrong, because it leads to preserving the lives of American soldiers at the expense, inevitably, of civilians in the country where the war is going on, which means we use air power to bomb insurgents in their hideouts instead of taking the risk of sending in ground troops, which has been going on in Afghanistan and increasingly in Iraq. So that leads to the question of, is this all just for show? David Petraeus is now the commander in Iraq, and under his command, we are increasingly using air power to fight insurgents. It's directly contrary to what this manual says, which is you limiting civilian casualties is not just a good thing in principle, it's the way you fight the war, and that means you put American lives at greater risk. Well, I think politically and for other reasons, that's just too difficult to do after 4 or 5 years of war in Iraq, and I don't think that we're fighting the war in that way that the field manual says. But there were two sets of criticism of this field manual at that conference, and I would say in general. One of them comes from the progressive side, and it's essentially you're just trying to prettify or to rationalize or to tame something that is essentially untamable. Counterinsurgency is always going to be brutal. It's a particularly brutal form of war because it involves civilians, and to talk about the laws of war and about the 10 paradoxes and the et cetera is just a lot of intellectualizing of something that's fundamentally wrong. And here's what Sarah Sewell says in her really wonderful introduction about that. The skeptics most likely to care about conduct are generally ambivalent about shaping it, for good reason. Even where the new manual promises better, it may simply be a lesser evil. The ideal is rarely an option in war. Humanitarians often avoid wading into the conduct of war for fear of becoming complicit in its purpose. The field manual requires engagement precisely from those who fear that its words will lack meaning. In other words, the soldiers need the human rights experts and the lawyers, but the human rights experts and the lawyers are the very people who may simply not want to get involved. An example of that, which I wrote about last December in The New Yorker, and which is becoming a pretty interesting aspect of the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan, is the Army's recruitment of anthropologists and other social scientists to actually embed with brigade combat teams that are deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan as sort of social science advisors to help them understand the societies in which the wars are going on in a way that, of course, the military very quickly knew it didn't at the beginning. This was a cry for help straight from the battalions that were in Salah Hadin province that led to this program. Well, it's pretty controversial, as you can imagine. I mean, ever since Vietnam, there has been a real great wall separating social science and the military, because social scientists felt that they were used in Vietnam and had become implicated in some unsavory things. There was also something called Project Camelot, which was Robert McNamara's effort to use social scientists simply to analyze the stability or instability of various countries around the world. When it broke, and that seems relatively tame compared to what this program is doing, when that story broke, it ended the program. So there's a historical antipathy and mutual suspicion between soldiers and scholars, which Petraeus, Sarah Sewell, this program of anthropologists is trying to overcome, because the individuals that I just named sort of recognize that the post 9/11 wars are wars that require soldiers to be social scientists, which is David Kilcullen's definition of counterinsurgency, armed social science. So to win these wars, this old antipathy has to be overcome. And of course, part of the criticism comes from the social scientists themselves. I think the American Anthropological Association is debating a resolution which will condemn this program. And there was an op-ed about it in the Times a few days ago. The criticism from the other side was, war is ugly. Winning hearts and minds is not what it's about. It's a fool's game. And we shouldn't try. The Powell Doctrine and the Curtis LeMay Doctrine are closer to the truth about war than the Petraeus Mattis Field Manual. And we're tying our hands in Iraq and Afghanistan by attempting to fight these wars by this book. Edward Luttwak wrote an essay in Harper's calling counterinsurgency malpractice. This is sort of from the right, the criticism. And I think both of these criticisms have a fair amount of truth to them, and they resonate with the American public today far more than the Field Manual does. This book and the ideas that it contains and the project that both soldiers and civilians have undertaken jointly are really out of favor. And I think this book is going to have a very hard time gaining traction for several reasons. One, institutionally, the Army just doesn't want it. David Petraeus may have made his reputation on its basis. Junior and field grade officers in Iraq swear by it because they've lived it and they've seen their friends die by it. They have found out the hard way that you cannot simply ignore the fact that there is an insurgency and pretend that you can fight it by conventional means. But senior officers back in Washington regard this and the efforts that I've talked about as a kind of eccentricity that the Army is eventually going to have to put behind it if it wants to regain the clout it's lost in Iraq and Afghanistan.
What's the story they tell about winning then? Is the LeMay strategy? I mean, what's the alternative then in their account of?
Well, there are two of them. One is don't do it at all, which is essentially what the Army learned after Vietnam. It obliterated whatever lessons of fighting insurgencies had been learned during Vietnam, and there were many, in favor of don't get involved in these messy, dirty little wars. Fight conventional wars, tank on tank, that's what we do well. Well, it turned out that after the Cold War, tank on tank was no longer applicable. There's no country that's going to fight us tank on tank. There's no group that will. There are groups that have very cleverly learned that they can bring us to our knees with re-engineered artillery shells and rocket-propelled grenades, the crudest weapons in the battlefield, and yet incredibly effective when the eyes of the world and public opinion, both here and in those countries, are essentially where the game is being won and lost. So one is don't fight it. The other is if you find yourself in it, don't tie yourself down. Just blow them away. Pave Anbar province. You know, it's a kind of a crude and testosterone-fueled attitude that, you know, war is about, you know, offensive power. And there were a couple people at the conference who basically told Petraeus, you're trying to turn war into something that it isn't. So just to conclude, I mean, this for me is a dilemma that's not resolved, and it's a question we're going to face as a country, and Western countries are going to face. In fact, in Afghanistan, it is a question for other Western countries who are involved in what they regarded as a peacekeeping mission, which has turned into a counterinsurgency mission. And there's constant tension, which Roger Cohen and others have written about, between the U.S. and the other NATO countries about whether the Dutch, the British, the French, the Germans are there to fight an insurgency, or are they there to do what the 90s gave us, which is peacekeeping? This decade suggests that peacekeeping is no longer sufficient unto itself, that there's something else that's harder and tougher called counterinsurgency. But I think that the question will be whether both institutions of governments on the civilian side, which is way behind the curve compared to the military, and on the military side, as well as opinion in areas of expertise like human rights and law and journalism, and public opinion in general, will take from Iraq the lesson that we should do it better, not necessarily the way we did it in Iraq, but if the idea that we're going to inevitably find ourselves fighting insurgencies on much smaller scales than the Iraq war and without that kind of massive intervention, but nonetheless inevitably, and we should learn to do it better, and we should all read the counterinsurgency field manual, or whether we simply should not do it because it is either going to taint us or we will simply inevitably lose because insurgencies are so difficult to defeat. That question is hanging in the air. I'd like to see the candidates for president talking about it a little bit more than they do, because I think it's a crucial foreign policy and security question for the post-Bush era.
Great. Well, thank you both very much for those really fascinating talks, and all the better, I think, for capturing some of the dilemmas and complexities of the moment and expressing some of the ambiguities of the causes that we're all committed to. Now, as you might have heard, I think if for people who want to ask questions, and please, we'd like this to be an open discussion with all of you involved, you are supposed to go and line up behind the microphones. So please go and do that. And
it's too high.
We'll take questions.
One of the issues that I think, I don't know how many Middle Easterns are in this room, but I think the fact that this administration or America as a whole doesn't understand the cultural differences in Afghanistan, Afghanistan and in Iran. In Iraq. One of the things that happened in Afghanistan and also in Iraq more than anywhere else, women went undercover. Here we are invading the nation. The first thing the Iraqi do, they cover their women. You break into their houses in the middle of the night and you look at their women, their man is going to join the insurgency. They're going to join the Taliban. And then they say the Taliban's are rising, but they don't realize that you break into their house and you look at their women for their honors. That's one of the issues that I think they keep failing in understanding the cultural values and differences in their society. And I think, as George was mentioning about the social scientists bringing it really should be the main issue to bring in the social scientists to teach the soldiers that this is how you deal with.
I'd love to take your point and then ask George a question, if you don't mind, because I'm just really curious. But just to your point, I think the only evidence on the front end of great cultural sensitivity was actually in how we tortured. That's actually the only evidence that anybody was paying attention to Islam, as far as I can tell. And it was systematic that you saw the same forms of torture in Bagram from late 2001, early 2002, to Guantanamo, and then to Abu Ghraib. And that understanding of everything from nakedness to shoes to menstruation to, obviously the Quran. I want to ask George, which just draws on your point, whether there's not a built-in, this is maybe just the most pathetic testament to how I will grasp at straws for silver linings, but is there not a built-in kind of prophylactic human rights friendly or humanitarian check on our dealings in these places? Leave the counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, whether we're doing it part aside, but to the degree that we're encountering other cultures, doesn't the fact that more people want to kill us when we do it badly, or that more people join the insurgency when we don't understand anything about a culture where we put, you know, where we, the jackboot goes in the human face, as Orwell used to talk about, is there not some, I mean, don't the NIEs, the National Intelligence Estimates, in some measure show that there's more, it may be a dangerous nexus, but that there's more of a nexus, more of an actual practical strategic nexus between compliance with our values and actually being safer? Or is that just naive?
No, I mean, that's the theory. That is the theory behind this book, that soldiers should respect the people whose houses they're raiding, and should follow the laws of war, not just because it's right, but because otherwise they create more enemies, and they can't afford to do that. I think the practice is something else. I mean, it's pretty hard to respect people whose house you're raiding. I've been on many raids, and there's a kind of a cycle to them, where at the beginning the soldiers come in revved up, scared, determined to show that they're in charge. They don't make fine discriminations between someone who's 50 and someone who's 40, or, you know, waiting for the women to leave the room before they start searching the man. But by the end of it, they're almost apologizing, because, at least in some cases that I've seen, because maybe through experience they've learned that what they are leaving behind is ill will, and that's come back to bite them. One sergeant said to me, you know, we have to turn ourselves on and off so many times in this war that I worry about my guys just breaking down. We should have two different armies, he said. Mm-hmm. One army that does the raids and the other that hands out the food. But our army is trying to do both, and you can't do both, because those are two totally different modes. In one mode, everyone is the enemy, and you're going to let them know that if they mess with you, it's going to be the end of them. And the other mode, we're trying to make friends with them, as the soldiers sort of put it in a crude oversimplification. It's really hard in practice. And that's why this book, I often ask myself, you know, if some NCO or below got a hold of this in Iraq and started reading it, and they might just laugh at it. Say, this has nothing to do with what daily life is like here. I'm just trying to stay alive. So it's the hardest form of warfare, as the authors say, and the insurgents know it, and they make it as hard as possible by terrorizing civilians and provoking the counterinsurgents into overreacting.
But just to pick up one thing you said there, which way do you think the trend is going? I mean, it's, you know, on the one hand you said, like, the soldiers have been there. In some cases, they're the biggest fans of this approach because, you know, they've developed it on their own. They've had to. People who've done raids have, you know, they learn. But on the other hand, also, it's a very brutalizing war, and there are all this research that shows people who've done three tours of duty are indifferent to civilians.
It's very hard to generalize because every unit is different. Some units are totally ignoring this. Their leaders are sticking with, you know, aggressive tactics. But I know a lot of soldiers who have learned the hard way and quite deeply about counterinsurgency. I think that one question that's a corollary of the one I raised at the end is, will their knowledge be absorbed into the institutional memory of the military, or will they be the next Vietnam generation who feel that their experience didn't count, and will they leave the army, as some of them are already, in bitterness, because they come back, and even if they come back wanting to, in a sense, educate their own institution, their institution might just crush that. And I'm afraid that's what's going to happen, that they will be the, you know, the sort of bitter few who over time learn how to do it. And I do think the army has been moving in that direction, but in the end, it was lost experience.
In the old days, they didn't have any place to go other than maybe a training academy or retirement. Now they can go work for DynCorp.
they can do that.
I mean, there's a huge hemorrhaging in that direction, because when you have that, when you are torn inside, you shut down, you can go.
The other thing I forgot to mention is during that very conference in February 06, the Samara Mosque was blown up, and Petraeus was on the phone with congressmen who were saying, "What the hell is going on over there? This is terrible." And Petraeus was trying to calm them down. Well, it turned out that was a decisive moment. It was the moment when what was already a sectarian conflict became an open civil war, which meant all the things they were learning in this conference and that are in this book were less and less relevant, because this is not a manual for how to fight a sectarian civil war. It's a manual for fighting against an identifiable insurgency against a legitimate or semi-legitimate government. So that's part of the problem. These wars are constantly changing. Iraq has changed 10 times since I was there last, so I hesitate to even comment on the current situation. And that is a tremendous challenge for these soldiers.
Do we have the next question?
Well, George actually answered somewhat in the negative the question I was about to ask, but I'll frame it in a slightly different, perhaps more optimistic fashion. And that is really the question of what is the time scale for thinking about how long it's going to take for there to be some, I don't know, if rapprochement or at least some serious dialogue between military and civilians. I was at a conference at USIP a week ago, and people were still referring to NGOs as force multipliers. Now, if you want to enrage NGOs, tell them that they're there to multiply the force of the military.
Right.
Or, you know, in some brief time I spent in Iraq, I mean, one of the things that I discovered was that the military who were responsible for civilian activities had an equally hegemonic view of that task. Mm-hmm. But clearly, I mean, there are folks who are learning, but I think it's a long-term issue. And the question is, how do you actually, you know, if you believe that that dialogue is possible, and obviously you're casting some doubt on its possibility, how does one make that go forward? Mm-hmm. And what is the ways, the kind of institutional and political fashions in which one could...
Well, it's been a question since the 90s, because yeah. Iraq wasn't the beginning of this encounter between these strange different groups. But so maybe Samantha wants to.
Well, just
to
add one point. I mean, I think maybe you'd answer on the Iraq front. But one of the things the manual does, the sort of reverence to this manual is crazy. But it's just crying out for civilians to show up. Even, I mean, George is painting a picture of this kind of continuum of thought within the military, the level of self-scrutiny, the level of rejection of new models, the knowledge of the political clock that is going to dictate the military clock. I mean, but that whole conversation is about what the military is thinking. I mean, at least they're having that conversation. There's, you know, one of the reasons the military is forced into absorbing these functions is that they're at staff, they're ramped up. If you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. The hammer's ready to go. There was no corollary hammer of, and they still can't. I mean, now you saw the latest is forcing people to go and serve in consulates and PRT, provincial reconstruction teams, and so forth, in places that people don't want to go. So, I think we need to have this sort of everything, including this manual, comes back to the fact that on September 12th we were all told to go shopping. And we weren't given, and to this day, all these years later, there's no path by which people who might bring more technical expertise on the civilian side might actually ramp up. So you have self-criticism on both fronts, but also scaling up so that you're grown, like the two grown-ups at the table, rather than a grown-up and then...
Yeah, back to politics for a moment. Giuliani is the candidate, I think, who most often talks about the need for a civilian nation-building, peacekeeping, reconstruction capacity. There's been a lot of talk over the last few years about reorganizing government so that we don't just have a tiny little office at the State Department with no resources and no personnel being responsible for these massive problems that we're constantly trying to improvise our way through. It worries me that Giuliani is the candidate who's talking about this. I mean, it suggests that this approach to foreign policy could become the possession of the people who will be claiming 20 years from now that we could have won the Iraq war if only we had not fought it with one hand tied behind our back. It would be interesting to see if some of the Democrats, and I know they've talked about it, but they haven't made it signature issues, if that becomes part of their program, because there's just an obvious dysfunction across the government time after time whenever we try to do one of these interventions. And Iraq, I think of it as like a stress test that revealed that the organism was close to failure when it was under that much pressure across the government. Every institution failed. Again, is the answer to make those institutions capable of it, or to conclude that this is not something we can or should do? And that's just a debate that we need to have.
Next, and I should have said, for people asking questions, if you've got some, you know, affiliation or name that's going to help people place you, or, you know, for instance, your work, I'm sure people know.
So. I'm Mark Danner. I had a comment and a question. The comment is about Abu Ghraib, I was interested by your point about, you made the point that the effect here and possibly worldwide was much greater than in Iraq itself. Which is an interesting point. I think it's a difficult, obviously, thing to quantify.
Yes,
but I think I'd like to point out that it did have a catastrophic effect on one part of Iraqi society, which was the secularists who had hitched their wagon to the United States and the United States project in Iraq. And for them, although they'd already been battered and damaged by that point very much by all the mistakes, as we've come to call them, of the occupation, Abu Ghraib was really a stake through their heart politically.
Yeah.
And I remember very well interviewing in Baghdad people who were so anguished by these photographs. And as you say, Iraqis had suspected this was going on. There were jokes going around about electricity and so on long before the photographs came out. But the people who didn't believe this were the believers in the American project
in
Iraq.
That's absolutely right.
And
yeah.
It destroyed them politically completely. The other point of the question has to do with counterinsurgency. And I think... I like you, have covered counterinsurgency. I met Major Nagel at Habaniya, Major Nagel at Habaniya early on in October 2003, when he said, you know, we're not set up to fight. This was off the record, to fight a counterinsurgency. Look at the, look at the equipment we've brought. We don't know what we're doing. After Vietnam, all of it was burned. All of the material about counterinsurgency.
And he now says it on the record all the time, which
exactly.
is one sign of progress. Maybe.
Well, he had, you know, I was traveling around Iraq with people from 60 Minutes. Every time we had to show our badges, the people would get to me and see New York Review of Books, and the soldiers would say, "What?" And the 60 Minutes people would laugh. Mm-hmm. And outside the Habaniya base, this had become a rather miserable experience for me, but outside the Habaniya base, they went through 60 Minutes, aha. And then this guy looked at the badge. New York Review of Books is my favorite magazine, he said. And this was Major Nagel.
Yeah.
So there he was raving about counterinsurgency.
Funny he said that about the New Yorker.
He told me he said that, but he said not to believe it, if you told me. But what I'd like to say about counterinsurgency is, you know, the political context, obviously, as Petraeus says, as Nagel says, as all of them say, is critical in the theater. But the theater becomes the home front as well. And
yeah.
I remember well talking to an operations officer in Baghdad who I asked, and this again was early, what is the center of gravity for the enemy? You know, the enemy, when they look at the center of gravity that they need to destroy on our side, on the American side, what is it? And he paused, he was kind of perplexed, and he came up with the answer finally, the will of the American people. That's the center of gravity. And, you know... The fact is that counterinsurgency is a supremely difficult kind of combat, kind of war to fight for democracies, because the will of the American people or the will of the population is targeted. And it's one of the reasons I think the United States has been so bad at it. And I think we should remember that this war was not intended to be a counterinsurgency. It was intended to be a 3-month shock and awe, massive campaign of firepower with all but 30,000 troops withdrawn before the end of the summer of 2003. That is what they had planned. That was formally planned. And it was, in effect, sold that way. And if it had to be sold as a 5-year-long, 10-year-long engagement with steady deaths and mutilations and 40,000 casualties, it wouldn't have happened. So I think there's a danger here when we start saying, you know, the wars of the post 9/11 world are going to be counterinsurgencies, which has now become kind of a cliche. I don't think actually that's true. I don't think that's true because I think the United States, in a fundamental way, isn't set up to fight those kinds of wars.
Well, I guess it depends on how you define them. I think with 150,000 American troops occupying a foreign country, I think you're right. If it's a matter of trying to improve the performance of the Pakistani army in the northwest frontier, that's counterinsurgency as well, and we may well.
But that is not a counterinsurgency war. Maybe I misunderstood you. I thought you said the wars of the post 9/11 world will be counterinsurgencies. That's what I heard you say.
Well, just
helping other militaries.
It is counterinsurgency. It absolutely is. It's just not being fought by Americans in the lead, but we're certainly involved.
I'm sorry, so you're talking about a 1960s Alliance for Progress, Green Beret, other militaries.
I look around the map, I see Afghanistan, I see Pakistan, I see all sorts of areas where there could be Afghanistans and Pakistans. It doesn't seem like it's going to stop anytime soon. I think Iraq as the model is over. We're not going to be in the lead. We're not going to be occupying foreign countries, but we're going to be, I think our soldiers, whether special forces alone or conventional forces as well, are going to be fighting these kinds of wars for a long time.
Well, I may have misunderstood that point. I just wanted to add one thing, and maybe you can comment on it, which is, it seems to me that there's been developing in the last couple of years a counter-narrative about the Iraq War, which the magnitude of the mistakes has allowed to occupy the political terrain. And that counter-narrative is, it was a good idea, bad execution. And I think there's a problem with that, because as soon as you got into a counterinsurgency, in effect, the U.S. had lost the war, in my opinion. There were a lot of mistakes, but the essential problem was the character, the idea of fighting this particular war of choice itself, and the major obstacles that were to be confronted there could have been, and were by many in the military, anticipated. So my argument, I guess, had been this wasn't a matter, at the end of the day, of technique, and it won't be a matter of technical change within the American government or the American military.
Do you want to come back on that, or maybe we should move on?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big discussion. I think you're basically right, but once we were fighting it, I think my sympathy is basically with those fighting it who are trying to fight it better. Whether they should have been fighting it at all, I think history's going to say Danner's right. But by late 2003, there really wasn't a choice. They were in the thick of it, and they had to. Yeah. So anyway.
Samantha, can I just move away from counterinsurgency for a minute? Can I ask
Riveting.
You? Yeah, I want to ask about the responsibility to protect, and particularly I want to ask about how you gave this fascinating sketch of the different factors at work. And I was wondering how much do you see the UN as it now stands, the UN system with the Security Council and the UN Charter and all that, is there a solution that runs through the UN as it now stands? And I'm particularly interested in this coming from Europe, and you're absolutely right about Europe, and there are groups of people in Europe trying to think how we can do this better, but the big split running through the heart of Europe is that there are a lot of people just will not countenance anything that's going outside the Security Council, whereas other people are more willing to look at some kinds of things. And in the United States, historically, there's been a bit more willingness to go outside the UN, but then, as you said, the US is, for the moment, terribly compromised in its ability to mobilize a coalition for humanitarian reasons. So, and then you also have the, as you said, the resurgence of these powers on the Security Council that have given lip service to the responsibility to protect, but then when it comes to, for instance, the debate on Burma, they turn around and say, actually, our considered view is that the internal matters of a state are not any business of the outside world, thus contradicting the responsibility to protect. So is there a way that that the UN system can be, that the responsibility to protect can work through the UN, or is it always going to be, do we have to sort of think about something else, coalitions of democracies, regional groupings, whatever?
Well, it's hard to, and I apologize, I didn't see Mark as part of the Bosnia generation. I just missed him here in the front, but very much a part of that posse back in the day. But I think that it's hard to do a thought experiment right now, actually either on the mass atrocity front or on the national security front. It's hard to come up with even the most hyperbolic scenario, like the worst thing you can possibly conceive of happening within a state, if you can't do a thought experiment and imagine getting Security Council consensus for a non-consensual military intervention, for instance, like for Rwanda happened, but let's say it's, give yourself even a little more time, give yourself 200 days, and give yourself 1.6 million people, you know? I don't see how China and Russia, maybe I underestimate that kind of savagery if exposed properly and with the right gradient, because there's some issue of you can't kill, it's like a terrible version of a nursery rhyme, you can't kill too quickly or too slowly in order to get the sort of attention. It has to be just so. There has to be just newsworthiness enough, not so chronic that you feel like you've been living with it and it's, you've kind of gotten used to it. In any event, but I think the fact that, on the national security front too, partly because of this legitimacy deficit and just an utter lack of credibility behind whatever we in this country say, but even if you had a scenario by which Iran were on the brink of not just having, but doing something, the odds of actually convincing anybody of that, we are the consummate sort of boy who cried wolf. The UN, though, is a little bit of a... you're asking an important question. There are a lot of different parts to the UN that have bearing on the issue of the responsibility to protect. You're focusing on the authorization side, which is very important. That's where I think the clog exists. And when it comes to resolutions like the one we got a few months ago for Darfur, which is the authorization of a 26,000-person force, and with diplomacy done behind the scenes, so you get a spasmodic acquiescence by Bashir so that the Chinese feel like they're not actually authorizing something that's confrontational. They feel like... it's not pretty diplomacy and it's not serious diplomacy, but it was a diplomacy enough to create a kind of permissive environment within the Security Council to authorize something that the people who don't care about Darfur weren't afraid would actually require anything. So those kinds of authorizations I think we'll do fine with. What we have to, I think, just move away from thinking is that the UN can fix, when in fact the UN won't fix, we'll fix. States will fix. There will either be less polarization and less of a desire to do the opposite of whatever the United States does. There will either be, as Roger has written about brilliantly, a domestic debate within not just Europe as a whole, because that also... once you start talking about Europe, then if everyone's responsible, then no one's responsible. So country by country, some kind of discussion about whether this commitment is going to be taken on or whether it's real. Obviously, protection is going to be conceived of in ways other than military, and then you'll be more permissive space there. But I think there's a second part of this. So A, I think we're clogged. B, what that requires is... actually dealing with interstate relations and state-by-state interests, which is just very hard. But C, I think what it'll mean is you'll see a delegation, or it's like a market failure. You'll see decisions vesting downward to regional organizations who themselves are comprised of states who don't feel any interest necessarily in doing things like that. But the other thing I just wanted to draw attention to, which you didn't mention, is there's the authorization piece and then there's the implementation piece. And this, again, is Roger's point about NATO, is that we talk about NATO as if NATO is some alternative to the UN. NATO is comprised of states that don't want to be dying in distant places where they don't feel like they're at stake in the insurgencies. And so there's Mark's domestic point about our democracy and our incompatibility with these struggles. And then there's the fact of our legitimacy deficit if doing it alone and our bench strength deficit if doing it at all, if other countries can't be brought along. And in the realm of the softer crises, the sort of, quote, the ones not pertinent on their face to national security, as you know, Europeans have totally gotten out of peacekeeping. You know, there were 2,000 or 3,000 Dutch peacekeepers active 10 years ago, or, well, 12 years ago, under the UN flag. There are 216, I think, today. The same, you go every country, Denmark, you could go to Canada, it's the same thing. So middle powers are abdicating totally on those 15 to 18 UN missions that don't trigger either the relationship with the United States or some long-term conception of national interest. And the Bangladeshes and the Uruguays of the world are totally overstretched and weren't terribly great at those kinds of performing those kinds of roles to begin with. So the UN is a very, it's a very broken place right now. But again, the answer is not to look to the UN to be the source of the fix, because as we go regional, those problems are going to replicate, because the problem is that there our unit of action is the state, and states haven't yet oriented themselves in this direction. Those problems are going to emerge regardless of what the convening forum is. But the Security Council presents its own particular problem because China and Russia are just on their face opposed to violations of sovereignty in that way.
So we have quite a lot of people waiting, and we're running out of time. So if you could ask relatively short questions, and we'll take maybe a couple of questions at a time and then answer them. Thanks.
Okay. Just quickly, you started the... Okay, Manuel Toscano, hi. No affiliation, thank you. the talk started with the description of currently the ethical quicksand that this current administration finds themselves in if they talk about Darfur on one side and they talk about, of course, waterboarding on the other, and they say one is and one is not, regardless of how the wind blows. Now, in this conversation, you've been talking about the legality of war, or in the sense the bringing humanitarian aspects to the function of war. But throughout the talk, there hasn't been, from a legal point of view, at least from somebody who is not so aware of the legality of international law when it comes to Iraq and the way that the occupation is currently being handled, the distinct difference that there is between a war of defense or a war that is somehow justified by international law and one that is not, and one that is an occupation and no longer a war of, let's say, between countries, as you have mentioned. So isn't the humanitarian organizations that function and participate in this also in their own way finding themselves in sand that is quick? Thanks.
Thanks.
Olivia Rubagumia. I'm an intern at Human Rights Watch, just an intern. And my question was, with the increasing permeation of legal obligations in warfare, and you know, military relationships between states, do you think there's going to be a growing informal, style of war whereby non-state actors such as paramilitaries and, you know, more shadowy creatures that work for states get to, carry out, you know, state interests and things without having that legal obligation or that kind of attention related back, for example, like in Sudan with the Janjaweed and, you know, these other kind of actors that make it hard to even pinpoint the responsible parties and just kind of stretch out the whole crisis and the whole accountability process. And if so, how can a discourse on, you know, international law and international humanitarian law, how can it be made effective and in that kind of sense? Thank you.
So we have one question about the legal characterization of the conflicts and one about, as it were, outsourcing of military or paramilitary functions. Do either of you want to jump in on either of those?
Well, on the second, I mean, it's a great question. we've done some outsourcing of our own, as we all know. That's where Blackwater comes in. It's a huge problem, and I mean, American soldiers in Iraq are forever complaining that they're under all kinds of restrictions, and the insurgents have essentially arrogated to themselves the right to do anything. And if insurgencies are impossible to defeat, that may be one reason. And leaving aside the center of gravity in public opinion in democracies, Iraq broke all the rules. I mean, things happen in Iraq. War is always terrible, but things happen in Iraq to civilians that still shocked the conscience of people who didn't think they could be shocked. And this manual's response is, we to defeat it, we have to be better than it. way better than it. It's a hell of a burden for soldiers to carry. And it may not be possible. That's the question I'm raising. But that is the way things are. That's the given. That's who's fighting wars now. And the distinction between counterinsurgency and counterterrorism is pretty hard to see in some places. So I'm just glad that the best minds in the military are facing that rather than simply saying, as some people who came out of Vietnam said, if only we'd been able to fight our way, we would have won that war. Well, that's not true. That's not the case in insurgency. You don't win by carpet bombing, and you don't win by blowing up civilians. If you're the counterinsurgent, if you're the insurgent, you might. That's the unfairness of it, but it's the way it is.
I would just add on that question. I have to confess I didn't fully understand the first question. And I'm always game to try to answer anything, even if I don't know the answer at all. But I have to have some. I wasn't sure if the question was about humanitarian organizations and whether they have a role. I just wasn't clear. Sophie, and I'm not sure George understood it either. So I'm
going to have a go.
Did you understand? Oh, then you have a go. Perfect.
Probably not. I'll try.
Perfect. Well, the great thing is when you don't understand the question, you can make up your own question and then answer it well. But on the case of the non-state actors, I just was struck when George mentioned Blackwater that I was just saying earlier that with the Security Council clogged, that it's like a market failure and there will be some entities, or either it'll just die on the vine because nothing can get through that's of pertinence to real lives or real states, or you'll see some kind of decentralization. I wonder if it isn't on some level that the private contractors and so forth, they're... It's so overdetermined why they sort of exploded into prominence in this war, but one factor was to meet unaccountable actors with unaccountable actors in some way. That your hands aren't tied behind your back in nearly the same way, and it's not at all. It's very predictable, in fact, that people who are not bound by rules will break rules they're not bound by, or will not even. I'm not casting every private security firm with the same brush, or every individual who works for them. But again, it's when you set up a structure by which there are no rules and there is almost no threat of accountability, it is very predictable that these kinds of excesses happen. So that's the minimalist account of it. The other thing I would say is that the entire interstate system is oriented, there's a narcissism to it. It's all about itself. States think in terms of entities that look like them. And none of the 192 governments in the UN is any good at thinking about entities that don't look like them. And in the case of the United States, there's even a reluctance to talk to or get to know or be in the room with. There's the whole kind of notion of legitimation of non-state actors. So you have this surreal fact that in a country like Lebanon, you'd have a Hezbollah actually more legitimate and arguably holding more of the sort of perks of sovereignty or the definers of sovereignty, and yet not being an entity that regional players or powerful international actors like the United States or even the Secretary General of the UN feels like they can be in the room with. And so we talk an awful lot about the 21st century and globalization and transnational actors and sub-state actors, but the system is still very anachronistically oriented toward the old kind of model of what states are and where control and power lie. And I think we need a big adjustment in a hurry. George mentioned earlier training and whether or not doctrinally this kind of, whether young soldiers are going to, what they're going to be groomed on. The same has to be true of young diplomats and college students and the way we read history and the way we teach history and whether we're teaching about non-state actors.
The best people in government know this and say we need to have diplomats in small towns. We need to post people in the middle of nowhere and not have them in national capitals where all they do is go to cocktail parties and talk to officials. They have no idea what's going on in the key places, the slums and the villages, which is where the future of these countries is being decided. But that's another massive institutional shift that I think the State Department may resist even more furiously than the military is resisting counterinsurgency.
Okay, I'll just very quickly try to address what I thought were the points coming out of the first question. And I guess there are two different things that I think we should distinguish. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
The first is, I guess, this sense that, you know, some wars are better than other wars, or maybe some wars are, you know, a war of aggression as opposed to a war of defense. And I think traditionally it's always been central to international humanitarian law that those questions are put to one side, that the sort of political questions of who's in the right and who's in the wrong are just ignored as far as the application of the law, partly because there's always going to be a debate, and the point of humanitarian law is to find something that, even in a war, that both sides can agree on. That's the principle. So it's a kind of residual contractual element of we can both fight this way even if we disagree about what's behind the war. So that's the principle, and I think it's getting harder to maintain it at the moment, partly because there is this kind of moralization of conflict that we see, and, you know, people go to war now with the notion that it's, you know, you're almost fighting under the banner of the law. You're fighting against a bad guy, against a rogue state, or whatever. And so I think, you know, just like the war in Iraq, which was a classic case of one country going to war with another, you know, it couldn't, there's no ambiguity that it's covered by the Geneva Conventions and so on, and yet it was portrayed by the administration as part of the war on terror, and I think that caused ambiguity on the ground. You know, George probably would know this obviously much better than I do, but from what I've read, you hear soldiers saying that, you know, these people that we're capturing are terrorists, and so the Geneva Conventions don't apply to terrorists. So I think that's something which is a very dangerous development. But the other question, which this touches on, I think, is the whole thing of how do we fit the kinds of conflicts that we're fighting today into the traditional categories of the laws of war, which have, you know, on the one hand, the international conflict between two states, and then on the other hand, the internal conflict, which is a civil war or whatever, and then no war. And now we have things where a state is fighting a non-state actor in another country, not only the global war on terror, but, for instance, Israel's war with Hezbollah. How do you define that? Was that a war between Israel and Lebanon, or was it a non-international conflict? And then the boundaries of where conflict are getting much harder. And in that sense, I think it's important to try to look at the whole spectrum of laws that apply, the common ground across the different forms of conflict in the laws of war, and also the intersection of human rights and the laws of war. So if you look at Guantanamo, there's a, you know, many people would feel that a lot of the detainees at Guantanamo really aren't part of anything that we would call an armed conflict. And so I think you have to look both at the human rights obligations there, the right against prolonged arbitrary detention, and so on. So I think the future is in a, you know, probably a new look at the fundamental principles and a better sense of how they interact, but, you know, not any new law. And let's take our final question, or final questions, if there are any other people.
Hi, my name is Artan. I'm doing my MA in sociology at the New School for Social Research. I come from the Balkans, from Kosovo, and I guess I am the living proof of responsibility to protect when it's done in the right time. I would just like to use this opportunity to thank Mr. Neyer for all the great things that Open Society has done for 17 years in Kosovo, because during the years of terror, Open Society was kind of small window of hope for us. Thank you again. I have a question for Professor Samantha about what do you think about the work of the International Tribunal for Crimes in ex-Yugoslavia? I mean, we all know what happened with Milosevic trial, now with Karadzic and Mladic. I mean, people who ordered killing of 8,000 people, now they are walking free for 12 years. And yesterday, Serbia signed an agreement of stabilization and association with European Union, which is the first step toward, I mean, is it a kind of humiliation of those victims, because real criminals are not, I mean, it's not that they are being tried and so on. Okay, thanks.
Well, Laura Silver's here too, another member of the Hugo gang, and I'm sure there are people who could speak to it with a more fresh perspective than mine. But I mean, I think the tribunal is has been cursed in some measure by untimely death of a very big deal kind of guy. But it of course was working out an awful lot of kinks on the dime of the international community, but also on the while victims and survivors were awaiting justice. So there's no secret that's been a huge number of mistakes made. I do think that, again, for all the failings of international institutions as they try to punish or try to protect, it is kind of interesting to see a single country like the United States try its hand at some of these things and see just how hard it is actually objectively to go and deal with foreign places and broken people in broken places. It sort of puts a lot of the failures, all of which are substantial, of the 1990s made by the UN and by the tribunal and others in some kind of perspective. But what I would say is that the tribunal is, again, very much like UN organs, going to end up being very much a symptom of interstate politics and dynamics. And right now, the fact that Russia is ascendant in the way that it is and feeling immune to international pressures, the fact that there is a leadership void, there's really no kind of leading moral voice internationally, as far as I know anyway, on any issue. I mean, on Darfur, for a while, it became Slovenia, which, you know, God love them. But same is true on Karadzic and Mladic. The idea, you know, when the U.S. ambassador for war crimes goes around the world and talks about the importance of arresting Karadzic and Mladic, it's, again, just simply impossible to be heard without the infection of what has gone on and the lack of accountability for crimes that we've committed in our own facilities. It doesn't mean that it should be. I mean, maybe you should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time, or torture and chew gum at the same time. But I think it's very, very difficult right now in terms of the tribunal and the International Criminal Court getting the kind of enforcement teeth that they need, because the states that, you know, until that changes, until George Soros has his own private army and gets to go arrest people, it's going to be states that are the people who have police, work in Interpol, and, in the case of the former Yugoslavia for a very long time had a military presence capable of making those arrests. It's going to be states with the kind of economic leverage that they can use or choose not to use. And what's happened is there's no political constituency that's kept its eye on the ball in the relevant countries. And so that's what's faded. And so if European governments can get away with making nice and, you know, pretending like history hasn't happened, that's what they're going to do. That's predictable. The question is whether there are elites or, again, particular constituencies who make that impossible to happen, and that unfortunately is what has faded.
Well, we're already well past our time, and so I think it's been a fascinating discussion, and there's a lot more that could be said, but I'd like to thank our two distinguished speakers again, Samantha Power and George Packer. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you again to Aria Nair for hosting this discussion.